Today on Against the Grain, as the world stumbles towards renewable energy, who will own the power from the sun and the wind? Is wind the common property of everyone or the private property of the few? Anthropologist David McDermott Hughes spent several years studying resistance to wind turbines in a southern Spanish village, from which he draws important lessons for the left and the environmental movement about the potential backlash against renewable energy from people in rural areas. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. For many people in metropolitan areas, solar panels and wind turbines, the backbones of renewable energy, seem positive but distant. For the residents of rural areas, however, they can feel like a blight on the landscape and an imposition from on high. For that reason, as he writes in Who Owns the Wind? Climate Crisis and the Hope of Renewable Energy, David McDermott Hughes argues that ordinary rural people must directly benefit from the production of renewable energy. David, as a start, what's the potential of wind power and solar power in comparison to fossil fuels?
Well, that's a very good question. It's a question that's often obscured in current debates about this. You have to start with the fact that 162,000 terawatts of solar energy is coming into, is encountering the Earth's atmosphere at any given moment. And about half of that, a little bit less than half of that, bounces back into space. So we're left with about 80 to 90,000 terawatts of solar energy. We use about 11 terawatts of all fossil fuels. So the solar resource is uncountably vaster than the fossil fuel resource. Now about 870 terawatts of that solar resource becomes wind. Not all of it is, of course, on the surface. Not all of it is on land or on the near shore. But there's a lot more renewable energy available to us at any given time than fossil fuels. So one of the problems that the oil industry has always had, and the energy industry in general has always had, is how to represent abundance as scarcity, because you can't make money off of something that's too abundant. So I actually think there's a lot of misleading information to suggest that renewable energy is scarce when it's not scarce at all.
You write about how capitalism depends on opening ever new frontiers for new avenues of profiting. How might solar and wind be part of that process? And how does that fit together with what you just said, which is that for profitability, those things have to be somehow considered scarce when, as you've just said, they exist in incredible abundance?
Thank you, Sasha. We're at a moment of transition now. I think it's become pretty clear that fossil fuels are being too slowly, phased out and replaced with renewables. I think this will happen at some point, probably by the end of the century. That vast resource is available for profit making as a new frontier. Now, the problem you mentioned, yes, is that if corporations were to take it all at once, then the value of wind or solar generated kilowatt hours would fall to zero and corporations wouldn't make any money off this. Now, the obvious solution here is to have an energy transition which is not dominated by corporations, but is dominated by some form of public or community ownership. That's not the way we're going so far in the United States or Europe. My book is largely an effort to advocate for that kind of a publicly owned energy transition. But what's happening now is more of a corporate-controlled energy transition. And in that case, capital flows are laying emphasis upon land. So land is scarce, even if the energy above it, floating above it, flowing above it, hitting it from the sun is not scarce. Land is scarce. So if land becomes the entry point into getting access to photons or to the kinesis of wind, then you have a bottleneck, you have a choke point, which is useful for constraining supply. And unfortunately, this choke point is actually supported by some legal precedents which give landowners control of wind rights. So the book is largely an examination of a failure of the energy transition in a particular part of Spain, where people who didn't own land and didn't own wind rights felt very much abused and mistreated and stopped the energy transition.
You write that, contrary to how we might imagine the kind of transition that needs to happen toward renewables, that societies tend to supplement rather than replace resources. What does that mean in terms of fossil fuels and renewables right now?
Yes, so I perhaps was speaking with too much hope by saying that the energy transition is happening. If we think of a transition as a substitution, as you said, it's not happening. What's going on is that we are adding more wind and solar to various national grids, and the percentage of electricity generated in different countries is fairly high. In Spain, it reached 18% for wind alone. It's up around 25-30% in the Germany and Denmark. But what you see is that those countries have added more demand. In Spain, the demand went up by more than 20%. So if you look at, and Spain is the fourth highest in the world for wind. But what happened during that whole buildup of the wind sector is that carbon emissions did not go down. Over the last 25 years in Spain, they've gone up by 1%. So that's a failure. It looks like a success from the point of view of the U.S. because we're a long way from 20% grid density for any renewables. But what the atmosphere pays attention to is carbon emissions. And carbon emissions are not going down, they're going up. And the reason for this is partly that, and I articulate this in the book, that the people who invest at the top of the financing food chain, the people who invest in wind and solar and other renewables, so-called eco-capitalists, are also investing in natural gas. If you look at the portfolio of a firm like Equinor, which used to be Statoil, the Norwegian oil and gas company, if you look at GE Energy Financials, for example, you'll see they're splitting their risk between old energy and new energy, which means that the incentives for them are to structure a system where we get half of our electricity from fossil fuels and half from renewables, and we double our overall production of electricity. So that may look good on a balance sheet that concentrates only a balance sheet that only represents grid density. But as I said, the atmosphere is looking at CO2 molecules coming at it and trapping heat. And that's the main thing. We have to reduce our production of CO2. So in a sense, we should not be paying attention to wind turbines. Wind turbines should actually not become the icon of sustainability. What should be the icon of sustainability is the retired oil, coal, or natural gas fired plant, the absence of something rather than the presence of something.
Right. So you're saying that ultimately the goal is the abolition of fossil fuels rather than some kind of combined portfolio of renewables and fossil fuels. And one of the things that you write about as an impediment to this, which is certainly a complicated story for people who are on the left and in the environmental movement, is that the transition to renewables may in fact trigger protests from below as well as blocking maneuvers by corporations from above. Talk about this, because you write that, you know, if you take China out of the picture, which has a authoritarian state that can pretty much do what it wants, 2/3 of the major carbon polluters are electoral democracies, you know, which sounds very good in theory, but in practice, what is the danger or the complications with a democratic response to renewable energy.
Glad you brought this up. I'm pro-democracy, just for the record. The problem you get into, though, let me tell it this way. I wrote this book. I began the research as what people have called a cautious moderate. Now, a cautious moderate is somebody who is actually incredibly alarmed about carbon emissions and climate change and believes that we have got to make the energy transition happen at all costs by putting up those icons of wind and solar farms and overriding any local concerns or local opposition. And this may be the way the Chinese government will eventually go about things. So that's what Spain tried. And it worked initially. You had a very rapid build out of solar and wind, particularly wind farms in the early 2000s. And then they hit a wall of popular opposition. And when I first heard about this popular opposition, I thought, well, you know, these are conservative people who simply oppose change and who deny climate change. And I'll go there and I'll find kind of a rural backwardness of some sort. That's not at all what I found. I found people on the left opposed to the energy transition, as opposed to the Spanish form of the energy transition, because they saw, number one, as I said, carbon emissions were not going down. Number two, they saw some of the oldest elites capturing all of the economic benefits of the energy transition. And they saw landless rural people descended from centuries of feudal era poverty, getting nothing and only suffering ill effects. I can go in later in terms of what those ill effects are, but only suffering ill effects. And so these local protests, actually, they didn't succeed in the village where I did the study. And that's why the village I did the study is one of the most wind turbine surrounded communities in the world. But the protests sent a signal strong enough to stop the construction of new wind farms in this particular province. And I think that's a story replicated in much of Western Europe and being replicated now onshore in parts of the US. So these movements have power. I think they have a certain amount of legitimacy because they are motivated in some cases by an anti-corporate pro-equality ethic. And I think it behooves promoters of wind to take these movements at least as seriously as they take the corporations investing in the sector. And that hasn't happened so far.
I'm speaking with anthropologist David McDermott Hughes. He's the author of Who Owns the Wind? Climate Crisis, and the Hope of Renewable Energy. He's professor of anthropology at Rutgers. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Well, tell us some more about what took place in this town, which you call Sereno, in Andalusia in southern Spain. How did wind power first come to Spain, and how did the locals initially understand the defeat of their opposition to wind power, and then ultimately the ramifications, which you argue was bad for the proliferation of wind power more broadly?
One thing I mentioned, that land rights carry with them wind rights, according to some not that well adjudicated legal conventions. So the land rights situation in this village has been unequal for centuries. I mean, going back to the Castilian conquest of this area from the Moors, which happened in the 13th, from the 13th to the 15th century, large aristocratic families got huge areas of land, which they didn't have the ability to actually put under production. And this carried on, as I say, for centuries and centuries. And so the family that now owns most of the land around Sereno is from the most petty nobility. They have huge estates all around. They don't really do much except raise cattle for bullfighting. So it's underutilized, underinvested land, no irrigation, very little cropping, very little employment, therefore. The people living in Sereno are technically squatters. They had been, until the 1980s, they had been living on these two upland ridges, which were taken by the military for a training ground. So people were evicted. People who were squatters there were evicted. They moved into this valley between the two ridges where the wind blows at great constancy and speed. And some of them have gotten legal status by now. It's a village of only 400 people. Many of them don't have legal status, and that's part of the reason why the wind turbines are so close, because the legal limit in Spain is 500 meters. A wind turbine should not be 500 meters from a house, but that has to be a legally recognized house. So some of these turbines are 300 meters. People learned of this plan late in the planning stage, in about 2006, and started protesting and blockading the road and things like that, and delayed construction. So it really wasn't finished until 2009, and caused enough attention in the press to make it difficult, as I said, to start any new planning process in the region.
So on what basis did they level their objections, and what role did aesthetics figure into their protest?
Yeah, so aesthetics, when you ask people in this village and when you ask people opposed to wind turbines in many places, they'll say, well, turbines are ugly, they make a terrible noise, they kill birds. I will talk about all of those. When I'd scratch beneath the surface, I found that people would very often live with that kind of harm if they got a revenue stream and if they felt they had some control over the project. They don't get a revenue stream because they don't have any wind rights. The aesthetic part, I spend a lot of time in the book thinking about that, because unlike the property, the economic questions, it's really hard not to compromise on aesthetics. And I'm encouraging people to see wind turbines differently. Part of what I have to explain to many of your listeners are probably people like me who don't live close to wind turbines. And so when we see them, it's in visiting them. And if we're environmentalists, we think, oh, this is wonderful. This is the icon of survival and of the future. And isn't it a beautiful, sublime object? People who live around these wind turbines see them every day. And in a place like Sereno, they say, well, we didn't choose this wind turbine. This was imposed upon us by the government in alliance with some large corporations who are taking profits from this wind turbine. And it doesn't do anything for us. On the contrary, it does some things against us. It ruptures the past of this landscape, introduces a kind of artificial industrial machinery to what was otherwise rolling hills of wheat or sunflower or cattle raised for the bullring. And it seems to be an ugly imposition. I think that there's a more imaginative way of looking at it. So I spent some time in the book looking at photographs taken by bird lovers and by people who actually work in the turbine fields. There are ways of representing them as beautiful. Once you've seen something as beautiful once, I say you can remember it that way for whenever you see it again. And actually, one of the things I talked about with a couple of the residents of Sereno had actually been to California and seen the Golden Gate, which your listeners know well, the bridge. And in lecturing about this, I've often asked people, how have they seen the Golden Gate Bridge? And the way they remember it is seeing it from over in Berkeley, or seeing it laterally, where you see the span of it from left to right. That's, of course, as it's shown in photographs. But people in San Francisco and in the Bay Area are more likely to see it driving or biking or walking across it. And when you're on it, it's actually not a very pretty thing. You're seeing cars, basically. Yet, we find this thing beautiful because we have an image of it in our mind's eye, which in some way replaces the experience of it. And that is the way many people look on technological objects after a period of time has gone by. Unfortunately, in this case, we'd want to accelerate the process because we don't have a long period of time for people who live by wind turbines to come to like them. And another aspect of this landscape that I bring up in the book is it actually already has a lot of industrial, even military, hardware on the landscape. Franco in the 30s put up in the 40s put up bunkers to protect the coast. And there are large guns, 8-meter guns pointed towards Morocco. This is by the Strait of Gibraltar. And people find those objects, if not beautiful, they find them to belong. So I'm in the book, I'm trying to make an argument here, in fact, with the opponents of wind turbines and telling them, or pleading with them really, look, can't you imagine this as something sublime, as something that belongs, as something that adds interest to your landscape? And this is another point I try to make about noise. So when you hear a wind turbine, there are two noises. If you're right at the base of it, you can hear a kind of high-pitched whirring noise, which is the sound of gears on metal. Basically, it's the gears of the turbine generating electricity itself. But you only hear that right at the base. If you move away from the base, what predominates is a noise that goes woo, 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 woo. And that is the pressure change as a blade. We're talking about the three-bladed horizontal axis turbines, which most people have seen by now. The pressure change as the blade moves past the tower. Okay? And people often don't like that noise. It sounds to me a lot like traffic, because you're not just hearing one, you're hearing tens of them in a landscape full of hundreds of them. So it sounds a bit like traffic. But again, Sereno is a small village of 400, that people aren't used to a constant traffic noise. So they object. And I often had conversations and I asked them what they thought they were hearing. And they said, we're hearing the machine. And in fact, what they're hearing, you could equally, with equal truth, you could say they're hearing the wind. Because the wind itself only makes a noise because it's brushing past an object, right? If you're in a hot air balloon, I've never done this, but people tell me if you're in a hot air balloon, you don't hear any wind because you're moving with it. It's not actually brushing past a fixed surface. So we hear the wind when it rustles the leaves, and we say the wind rustles the leaves. It's not really different when you hear a wind turbine. You're hearing the wind rustling the blades, right? I mean, you might be fooled into thinking the wind turbine is a fan where the blades move the wind, but of course we know logically that's not the case. If it's a fan, the blades move the air. If it is a turbine, it is a turbine. The wind moves the blades, right? The air moves the blades. So you're hearing a natural sound when you hear the turbine, when you hear that woo, woo, woo sound. So again, I'm encouraging people, it's a long-winded answer, I'm encouraging people in Sereno to think differently about wind turbines, about the aesthetics of them, and compromise there, even while fighting very hard for what I think is just, which is a different property arrangement. A more equal property arrangement and a more equal ownership of wind rights.
Well, one of the things that makes this complicated, aside from what you've just flagged about how something that might be human-made but established a century ago becomes an accepted part of the landscape, say 19th century windmills, but that something that appears abruptly in someone's lifetime in a short span of time can feel like an imposition onto Eden. And a lot of the environmental movement historically has been fueled by that abrupt reaction to, the machinery placed in the garden, this notion of some kind of rupture. And yet, what this speaks to is a sense of environmental change that is based on an embrace of a kind of technology rather than a kind of generalized rejection of it.
Yes, so quite an issue there. I'm not a fan of wilderness. I think the wilderness ethic has been has underwritten the dispossession of Native Americans and rural people in California and in many parts of the world.
Wilderness meaning this pure, untouched landscape.
Exactly, pristine nature. So what we've got here, the good news here is we have a disagreement within the environmental movement. So in a sense, I'd say as an environmentalist, it's on our territory, and I think we can handle this this disagreement as adults. The first point to note is that that wind and especially sunlight I mentioned, there's lots of it, lots more of it than oil, but it's really distributed very sparsely. So, you know, in an oil well that's 30 inches in diameter can bring up enough energy to power a city. To power a city from solar energy, you need something much larger than that city in terms of the expanse. So if we're going to power the whole world with wind and solar farms, they're really going to need to be in a lot of places, and not just in the convenient out-of-the-way places, but really in a lot of places in a lot of people's backyards. And they're going to be something new, and they're going to change what people think of as nature or as the nature of the place that they love. And I think an environmentalist would recognize that if we're going to stabilize the conditions for life on planet Earth, you know, pretty important thing to do, we're going to need to get used to wind and solar farms in lots and lots of places. Now, what I hope my book does is try to get people used to it and try to explain that we've done this before, right? We have roads, we have telephone poles. One of the exercises I often do with my students is I ask them what's an area they think of as wild and natural. And inevitably somebody in this region here in New Jersey will say the Appalachian Trail. And I'll say, oh, the Appalachian Trail? Well, I know that's not natural. And they say, oh, what section are you talking about? You know, somebody will have hiked all of it or a part of it. And I'll say, well, I haven't hiked very much of it, but I can just know from the, I can tell you from the name, it's not natural. And they'll say, the name, what do you mean? Appalachian Trail, Appalachian Trail. What, there's only two words. And I'll say, well, trail. It's a trail, right? Yeah, it's not. It's enormously obtrusive, but it's basically a thoroughfare built by people to bring more people through the area. As you walk on it, a good part, if you're looking ahead, as you mostly do, your eyes are actually falling on an artificial channel made for these human desires, right? So we've been here before as environmentalists. We've gotten used to stuff that is artificial and which in fact contributes far less to the conditions for life on planet Earth than a wind or solar farm would.
You cite the work of Murray Bookchin and this notion of liberatory technologies, which is a thread that also runs through the left in the environmental movement, which sees technology as something that can theoretically be liberatory and not just oppressive. And yet you also note that wind turbines, as conceived right now, can be the opposite, not necessarily liberatory for the people who live with them and around them. How do you understand that term, liberatory technologies? And for us to sort of get our heads around it, what ingredients are needed for something to potentially be liberatory?
Okay, well, so I get into that in connection with employment. So there's been a lot of talk, and unfortunately, I think it's too much talk about job creation in the energy transition and the green economy jobs that we're waiting for. And I'm not talking about the whole green economy. I'm just talking about the energy sector where we replace fossil fuels with renewables. That is a construction project. And of course, any construction projects will create a lot of jobs. You have to build turbine towers and blades. You have to stick them in the ground, make them stand up straight. You have to pour cement. Same thing has to happen with solar farms. You have to install panels on roofs, on buildings, over parking lots, in open fields, in many places. If we do the energy transition very slowly, then those jobs will last a century, and that will keep a lot of people employed. That will employ displaced workers from the fossil fuel sector. It will also employ, we hope, frontline communities who have been abused by the fossil fuel sector for a very long time. And that would be lovely for a century, but a slow energy transition won't stabilize the conditions for life on planet Earth. So we need a rather quick energy transition that happens in 25 years or maybe in 10. Right now, it seems that we need to convert the entire electrical grid in the United States to renewables in 10 years. So that employs a lot of people for 10 years. And then what? One of the astonishing things about wind turbines is they don't create a lot of jobs. The entire supply chain, once after the construction phase, the entire supply chain creates very few jobs as compared to, say, fossil fuels. And the reason for that is there's no extraction when it comes to wind power. There's no mine. There's no oil well. The wind is bringing itself to the turbine. And there's no disposal phase when it comes to wind power. Same thing with solar, right? Eventually, you dispose of, reuse, or recycle the materials. But there isn't ash, there isn't coke or something that you need to carry off and put in a toxic waste site. So all that means fewer jobs. Now, what we could do, and this is where Bookchin is helpful, we could think about what happens to those people, right? We don't actually need jobs as a way of organizing our society. If you produce the same amount of energy as for the same value with 10% of the workforce, we have a choice on what to do with the other 90%. The same money is there. If nothing changes, then that 90% is unemployed and the corporation gets to accumulate as wealth the wages not paid. So as we go into a much less resource-intensive economy, we've got to think about other ways besides jobs of supporting the resource-intensive workers. And so I'm thinking about universal basic income, which has already been put on the table with the child tax credit right now in the U.S., and thinking about the care economy and other ways of supporting people that are not jobs. Because I fear that as long as we make jobs the centerpiece of identity, self-worth, and of political advantage in the U.S., we will go out seeking more ways to convert nature into products and more ways to pollute, essentially. So we have to start thinking differently about livelihood beyond simply the wage and jobs.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with David Hughes. He's the author of Who Owns the Wind? Climate Crisis and the Hope of Renewable Energy. That's published by Verso. He teaches anthropology at Rutgers. The title of your book is Who Owns the Wind? And I wanted to ask you about that dimension of the notion of wind power being liberatory, because it gets to the heart of the argument that you make in your book. Tell us about how wind ownership has been understood historically. To what degree has a private notion of wind ownership been established, and how you think we should understand who owns the wind?
Yes. So what makes wind and solar liberatory is that there are so much of them in so many places, so available, and so easy to harvest. Unfortunately, as I said, in a way that hasn't really been thought about very much, landowners are grabbing wind rights And the only legal precedent, or the, let's say the root legal precedent, goes back to a Tuscan jurist nobody's ever heard about in the 14th century called Cino da Pistoia. And he was writing about the sorts of conflicts that would happen in Italian cities where somebody, to be two neighbors immediately adjoining, and somebody would extend the roof line so that it crossed the property line and the roof would kind of be hanging over somebody else's garden, right? And either shading it or dropping water on it or in some way bugging the neighbor. And so Cino da Pistoia established the ad colum rule, which is Latin, I believe, for to the sky. And it says that the owner of a parcel of land owns rights up to the sky. And so this is where it begins. And it's a very bizarre precedent because, of course, we violate it by allowing planes to fly over your house. But we don't violate it by allowing turbines anywhere near your house. So the way this happens then in southern Spain is that a landowner, these are latifundistas, which are very, very large estates, will make a deal with an energy firm for two payments. So the first payment is for rent. So, you know, wind turbines will each take up an area they call a pad, about half the size of a football field with some access roads and so on. That's all land that's coming out of agricultural production. And under normal property rights, the landowner should get some compensation for that in the form of an annual rent on a per square meter basis, right? All fair and good under capitalism and private property. The second payment, though, is this bizarre one based on wind rights, where the landowner gets a royalty, which is calculated as a percentage of the value of the electricity generated from each turbine on that landowner's estate. So it's that payment for wind rights that I think needs to be changed and needs to be made common through what I would call a wind commons. Could be socialized, could be nationalized, could be the wind rights could be owned by the municipality or the county or the view shed. These kinds of things could be determined locally. But that would change everything because it would mean that a village like Sereno would be drawing profit from this wind farm. It would mean that they would have a say in location, in design, in height, in the view corridor, in all kinds of aspects. Right? And what I think this would do is convert opponents into people welcoming, even people championing wind farms, because they become a means of local development and ultimately local pride. And that's exactly the way it should be, because the wind is a resource available to a free gift from nature, available to a region. Landowners didn't create the wind. They didn't do anything. They didn't invest in it. They didn't actually make it blow harder. And so this is the kind of liberation that we need in terms of a public seizure of a resource that should be public all along.
One of the threads that runs through your book, Who Owns the Wind, is the pairing of the idea of scarcity and plenitude. And you write that the environmental movement, at least since the watershed report limits to growth in 1972, but certainly earlier as well, has in the United States been very much focused on scarcity. And environmental responses to ecological crisis being one about enforcing limits, you know, that resources are becoming fewer and fewer, that we need to tighten our belts, consume less, and so on. And certainly an argument can be made for not decimating the resources of the world. But you also argue that the environmental movement in many ways has had blinders on around the question of plenitude as being another avenue of struggle. And that this is most apparent around renewables. Can you explain this duality of scarcity and plenitude and what lessons we can draw politically from them?
Yes, that's a great question about scarcity and abundance, Sasha. I think that people are, a lot has happened, in fact, since I've dropped my pen on the book, and people are starting to realize that wind and solar are quite available. But still, we have this sense that the locations are few, and we're almost imposing a scarcity on it. So where I live in New Jersey, people have gotten the sense that no one will accept wind turbines onshore. And so we're building or planning solar wind farms offshore. I think that's an opportunity missed. And what we need to do is we need to think of wind and sunlight the way we think of oxygen. It's just available. It's being harvested by us all the time. And with some technologies, we could convert it to electricity and reduce almost down to zero our consumption of fossil fuels. I'll give you one example of this. If you look at any chart of energy consumption in the US, it'll show little tiny slivers for wind and solar, and a very large sliver for fossil fuels of different kinds, and a pretty big sliver for nuclear. That's not true at all, because the reason that we're alive today is the reason we haven't frozen to death this morning is that our planet is closer to the sun than Pluto, and we're getting those 162,000 terawatts all the time. And so we're mostly living, without explicitly consuming it, we're mostly living from solar-generated heat and of course, illumination. And if we realized this, if we truly understood that we live from solar power and its derivatives like wind already, then I think it would be easier to make the small switch of introducing lots of panels and lots of wind turbines to convert that to electricity. What I really want to do is change the default condition. Most people believe the default condition is that we hunt around and we drill and so on and we scrounge around for oil, gas, and coal. That's not actually true. The default condition is that we're out here sunbathing all the time from this vast resource coming to us for free that we couldn't stop it coming at us.
I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about wind turbines and birds. One of the environmental arguments leveled against wind power is that it decimates birds. Is there any way around that?
Yes. Well, first off, the way around it most people think of is, this is the reason I like this is the kind of debate we want to have, because it's among people who care about nature, about biodiversity and the environment. It's not a debate between us and the climate deniers or us and the pro-fossil fuel people. So what I say to bird lovers is the easy solution is not going to work. The easy solution is you move the turbines away from the avian flyways. That's going to put the turbines in places that are not good for generating wind, because the birds are harvesting the same energy that the turbines are. So it's natural that it's logical that you'll find turbines when we do this build out. You'll find turbines in the bird flyways, the migration pathways. And southern Spain is one of those, because the birds are going across the Strait of Gibraltar between Europe and North Africa. The good news is just an only slightly harder solution, which they have implemented in this part of Spain, and that is hiring bird monitors. They call them vigilantes de aves. And these are people who are amateur ornithologists. They get hired to bring their binoculars and sit out there looking for kites, the kite species, for storks, and particularly for vultures. Fortunately, these are birds that fly mostly during the day. Look for them with binoculars, and if necessary, shut down a line of turbines. And they can do that on their own authority by calling the control room, the off-duty control room for this turbine, this wind farm in southern Spain is actually in Mexico City. They can call Mexico City on their phone and shut down a line of turbines. And these vigilantes de aves are not actually employed by the wind farm operator. They're employed by the provincial government. So that's a system that we could try in the U.S. I don't believe any other country has tried it. In fact, it would work offshore as well, if provided the vigilantes are, the bird monitors are in boats, and it creates jobs. So I think there actually is a pretty good solution about bird kill. Having said that, I would also remind everybody that the climate crisis kills birds for sure. The climate crisis, taken under a business as usual scenario, kills a lot of birds and a lot of species and a lot of human communities. So we should put the danger of bird kill from wind farms in perspective there.
What about wind farms and other land uses? To what degree can one continue to use land for things like crops and cattle and simultaneously use them for wind turbines?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, turbines don't take much land out of production. As I said, there's a little pad around each machine and some access roads, which may be used just as well for agriculture. So it's a land use that combines well with agriculture and with animal husbandry. Solar farms are a little bit harder to combine, although there's been a bunch of work on what's called agrivoltaics. Some good experiments in the Southwest where you find actually some positive effects on crops and on solar generation. Photovoltaic panels generate electricity best at 25 degrees centigrade or 78 degrees Fahrenheit. If you go higher than that, they start to lose efficiency. So an interspersing of crops and panels, the plants create a cooling effect immediately around the panels and lower the temperature so they generate electricity faster. The panels will shade the plants during certain portions of the day because in Arizona they may actually get too much solar radiation.
Let me end by asking you what you think should be done at this point. You've been arguing that renewables, especially wind farms, are on the one hand absolutely necessary and extensively so to slow climate catastrophe, and yet at the same time that there's a decent potential for popular opposition to wind turbines at the scale that they need to be effective. And so you have inertia at best from on high and of course the active impediments being lobbied by the fossil fuel industry. You have this potential for popular opposition to widespread wind turbines. Where do you think this leaves the left and environmental movements that see the climate catastrophe as central? Politically, where do you think things need to go to manage to navigate through these sort of rocky waters?
I'm very happy to address that question. So the advantage of being really slow and almost criminally slow in the United States to build wind and solar farms is that you can learn from the mistakes of all the people who are more proactive. And so we have the opportunity because we're at the start, we have an opportunity to go down a different path from what Spain and Western Europe have gone down, right? They've gone down the path of private wind rights enriching corporations. We could establish a wind commons. This is not terribly far-fetched. Alaska has a commons for mineral rights, including oil and gas, those are all owned by the state, and people get a royalty check, which is from the Alaska Permanent Fund every year, right? That makes oil and gas, unfortunately, all that makes oil and gas pretty popular in Alaska. So that's a subsurface resource. The suprasurface or above ground resource that I'm talking about is wind. We could write legislation that would establish public ownership of the wind. The left is not really talking about this so far. What some activists are talking about is public ownership of energy infrastructure. And that's about seizing transmission lines, nationalizing oil companies, nationalizing any wind and solar installations that come into existence. I'm all in favor of that. I think it's a little bit hard to do because the private property rights around that type of equipment are pretty well established, and you'd have to dispossess a bunch of firms and a bunch of pretty wealthy people in order to do it. So by all means, one could do that, but it's going to be a heavy lift. The easier lift is to socialize, to establish a commons for something that almost nobody actually even counts. And the people who own land don't even think about themselves right now. Most of them don't even think about themselves as owning wind. As for the public to claim ownership of something that's almost completely ignored shouldn't be that difficult. And one of the reasons we really need to do this is that land ownership in the U.S. is tremendously unequal. If you combine a study Bloomberg did with an earlier study based on race that the USDA did, you realize that there are 5 white families who own as much land as the entire African-American population of the United States. If we, perpetuate Sino da Pistoia's thinking, then there are 5 white families who own as much wind energy as the entire African-American population of the United States, right? And so the energy transition under that status quo, the energy transition will widen the wealth gap and the racial wealth gap extraordinarily. And again, I think people are not going to take that. I don't think they should take that. I think there will be opposition. So what we need to do very practically is establish a wind commons.
David Hughes, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. It was a wonderful time with you, Sasha.
I've been speaking with David McDermott Hughes about his book, Who Owns the Wind? Climate Crisis and the Hope of Renewable Energy. That's out from Verso and at againstthegrain.org. You can find a link to that book. He's professor of anthropology at Rutgers, and he's on the Climate Justice Task Force of the American Federation of Teachers. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.